This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
Free and uncorrupted communication.
I talk to you about biotechnology, and I presume most of you don't know what biotechnology is. At the same time, nearly all of you know the name Amgen, not far from here, clearly the most successful company in biotechnology, one that has put a number of drugs in the market, revolutionary drugs, useful drugs, good drugs. The name Genentech may ring a bell, and a number of others. There may be, at this point around the world, several thousand biotech companies, and they all have some common characteristics. What are they? Well, first of all, here's my definition of biotech. And is there a note from your mother along with for being late? Okay. My operational definition of biotech is sort of like a set of criteria that includes companies that are relevant. She's afraid to come in after what I just did to the other one. You can come in. It's all right. I don't know anybody here, don't worry. These companies must be young. Youth is an important part of biotech. All companies cannot be biotech companies. They must be aggressive in their mind. I was talking to an all-time CEO of a biotech company in anticipation of a speech we're going to give in a few weeks together in a big meeting, and he made the statement that biotech has innovated more in finance than in science, and I think that's part of the aggressive mindset of people. You know, most of us in this business sort of like have crossed from the other side. We were scientists. We're used to solving problems. We're used to looking at a situation and coming up with a set of solutions and recommendations. So aggressively minded in terms of problem solving, young companies pursuing exciting scientific developments. If it's not exciting, it's not good for biotech. Biotech is not for mundane stuff. Biotech is not to take a tired old drug that some company has forgotten in the back room, you know, put a new formulation on and put out in the market. Yeah, we often do that out of necessity or sometimes out of choice, but that's not the classic definition of biotech. Of course, the work is in the life sciences and primarily drugs. I'll go back in history and I'll tell you that some of these companies have actually endeavored in other areas away from drugs, but by far and away, the greatest success in certainly from a commercial point of view and a societal point of view, the greatest success of biotech has been in the introduction of novel therapeutic agents. And ultimately, this must have commercial implications because if I stopped what I was saying up until this point, I could describe a very good university because they're aggressively minded, they think creatively, they pursue exciting ideas, you know, they're in the life sciences. But the additional point of commercial implications in a commercial setting, that's what a biotech company is. And that's what I will be talking about, the world of biotech. Now, when did all this happen? Well, it all started really by serendipity and a great deal of intuition. There was a famous scientist, Herb Boyer. He was a professor. He was one of the two co-authors of the seminal paper describing how recombinant DNA technology was to be used. He met up with a then very young venture capitalist, a junior partner at the famous firm of Kleiner Perkins. The firm was famous for investments in the world of information technology, not biotech, of course. And Bob Swanson, his young partner, you know, was in his late 20s, met up with Herb Boyer. Actually, he sought out Herb Boyer. They became excited, they had a few beers, and that's a true story. They got together in a bar, they had a few beers, and at the end, they threw in $500 each and they incorporated, and that's how the company got started. If you go to the Genentech campus today, there's a bronze statue of the two guys in a bar drinking beer and, you know, having a good time. Herb Boyer never left the university. He stayed at the university all along. He made a significant amount of money as a founder of Genentech with stock from Genentech. He's donated a good part of that money. There's the Boyer Center at Yale, and I'm sure there are other places where he's donated money. Bob Swanson unfortunately died 4 or 5 years ago from brain cancer at the age of 50. Remarkably talented man. All this happened at a time when the Silicon Valley, the world of It was actually called the semiconductor business at the time. It was not even called information technology. That's a term of much recent vintage. You know, the Silicon Valley guys, the guys making disk drives and computers, were not even making disk drives back in the 70s. They were looking for a new idea, a new set of ideas, and they used their intuition. They smelled and sensed that this was interesting and potentially big. They never bothered to quantify it. Thank God for that, because if they asked anybody with a lot of knowledge and experience, and of course, it's easy, of course, to come back now and, you know, revise the past and see what I would have done had I known it differently. But the reality is, if anybody told those venture capitalists how much money it would take and how long it would take to get these companies into a commercial footing, a cash flow break even, nobody would have done it. Yet they did it, and they got bailed out later through serendipity, but I'll come to that in a moment. So Genentech was founded, and shortly thereafter, I mean, the world of venture capital is full of imitation, as is the world of Wall Street, by the way. Wall Street is really all about imitation. There's little originality on Wall Street. So shortly after Genentech, other companies got into the game. Cetus was around. For those of you who are older scientists, remember Cetus and the Cetus Symposium and the big posters in the labs. They were a big reagent company. They were selling pipettes and enzymes, and they were founded in 1971, a full 5 years before Genentech. Well, they saw Genentech getting all the publicity and all the, you know, the great attention from everybody. They said, well, if they can do it, we should be able to do it. I mean, we're in the world of biology as well. You know, let's get into the act. So they said, we'll redefine ourselves. And sure enough, they wrote a business plan, which was basically the Bible of, do I need water? Just in case I need water. Okay, thank you. And now I'm waiting for the sinusitis drug. It never clears. I'm waiting for his drug. I got this problem. So Cetus wrote this business plan. It was like the Bible. You know, it's all you could do if you had, you know, billions of dollars and you wanted to be in recombinant DNA technology. And a couple of other companies were started. Biogen was started in Boston by a group of scientists. And I'll stay in that slide for a moment. The group of scientists at Biogen were remarkably bright, rather loosely managed, and then Genex was started as yet another set of ideas. But now let's look at some facts. Genentech was founded in 1976. Great science, without a doubt. You know, first in class, best in class. They proceeded to do all the right things just about it. There's a book to be written of doing it right. They've done nearly everything right, in my mind, better than anybody else over the last 25 years. I mean, remarkably talented. They had an IPO in 1980. That in itself is a remarkable event. I'll come there in a moment. The valuation was $250 million at the time of the IPO. In itself, in those days, a big number. $31.5 billion market cap today. That number is as of 2 days ago. That's pretty remarkable. That's success, no doubt about it. Now here comes Cetus, the copycat. You know, they're late to the party, redefining themselves. Well, for some, you know, I don't want to offend anybody who was affiliated with Cetus, but there's no doubt in my mind, having known all the early guys, the founders, the CEOs, and all of that, the talent at Cetus was nothing compared to the talent at Genentech. Just vast difference. They did manage to have an IPO, $500 million. It was shortly after Genentech IPO. Genentech was October of 80. Cetus was in March 1981. And by then, the Genentech story played so well that they could really go out and, you know, act as if they're the new and improved Genentech. $500 million IPO, they raised $100 million. Believe it or not, in 1981, the $100 million IPO raise-up was the biggest ever IPO in industrial history on Wall Street. There was no bigger IPO. So if you think this internet stuff was all earth-shaking and paving new ground and, you know, setting records, of course it was. But, you know, those numbers were pretty big in those days. Bad management more than anything else. The company was sold to Chiron about 10 years later. It's ironic that Chiron was a small company that leased space out of Cetus in Emeryville, north of San Francisco, and at the end the tenant ended up buying up the landlord. But that's what the difference between good management and good science can do for you. And here comes Genex. That tells you the extremes of fate. Genex was started to really be different. They said, well, already the world of therapeutics is consumed by Genentech. We'll go someplace else. We'll do industrial enzymes. And they had all sorts of crazy ideas. If I told you the ideas, you would laugh. They developed an enzyme, which was basically an enzyme to break down keratin. and they have a little tube, and you take this and you sell it to the hotels so that when the cleaning lady goes into the room, they pour down the drain so the keratin will, you know, break down, the keratinase will break down the keratin of the hair, the human hair. Because I'm sure, if you travel as much as I do, I've yet to see a hotel sink that flows as fast as my own sink. Now, why is that? There's got to be something. It's probably human hair that's sitting there and just clogging up part of the way. So that enzyme was to do that. And of course, I went to the company to visit back in the 80s, and I said, give me the enzyme. I went home. I put hair in my sink. I clogged it up. I put the enzyme. It never worked. So then they extracted from muscles and adhesive, because I figured if muscles can stick themselves to rock so effectively and to metal, they must be secreting something. Indeed, they were. So they had this adhesive that was, you know, water friendly, so they can, you know, use it in underwater applications. And then they made some huge mistakes in committing to do manufacturing for aspartame, for NutraSweet, on behalf of Searle. They built a plant in Kentucky. They didn't have a good contract. Searle said one day, the contract expires in 3 months and we're going to manufacture our own aspartame. So thank you. It was nice knowing you. So they were stuck with the plant and nothing to do. So IPO in 1982, $100 million valuation. The company was sold for scrap, $8 million in 1991. So the notion about picking baskets, collecting companies, you know, it's not clear in the beginning who's going to be bad. And the last of the good ones, the early ones, Biogen, and that was more of an academic laboratory, a collection of labs coming together to form a company. Brilliant scientists, did some great work in alpha interferon and hepatitis. They had an IPO, a superb IPO, funded $30 million in 1983. And they went through bad times and good times, and they're still around. They got a big drug for multiple sclerosis. They're selling $1 billion on the market. They got a big operation, and they got a $6 billion IPO, and they're doing quite well. You guys having fun over there? Okay. Now, question. If I go back in history, and let's assume we constrain ourselves to drug and drug discovery-related applications, and you ask the question, why on earth did this small company succeed? And if you go to a number of other industries, you can say, well, why did Apple succeed in making microcomputers, as they used to be called in the old days? Well, in fact, there was no real competition as such. It's not as if there were 25 multi-billion dollar companies making microcomputers and they came up with, you know, their own version of microcomputer. They almost define a business and a market and a sector. In this case, we're not defining anything. We're defining a means of inventing and manufacturing. But the end product was any other product in the market. In fact, the first drug out of biotech was nothing but another way of manufacturing insulin. Insulin had been in the market, it had been manufactured for decades. The manufacturing process was established, the efficacy, the safety, it was sold into the marketplace for $700 million by multiple companies. And all Genentech did in conjunction with Eli Lilly is they developed a better way, let's call it, a more efficient way of manufacturing insulin, and they brought it into the market. So you ask the question, if you do this in the shadow of the giants, why did they allow you to do that? What did the pharma industry fall asleep and allow biotech to evolve and prosper? And I think in many ways they did. They did for reasons that I don't have time to go into today, but it's a fascinating story of large organizational behavior, how people, the bigger the organization, the more successful, the less willing they are to take risk. And that's something which is well understood in almost any sector, and it's uniquely interesting in biotech, largely because the uniqueness here is the great uncertainty in the drug development process and the great timetable. You know, if I'm sitting in a drug company meeting and we have to make a decision today about a drug, and let's say the drug is a preclinical project, meaning before we even test it in humans, the reality is that that will take a good 10 years before it is approved and sold in the market. And the chances are it will fail because the failure rate is enormous. So now here I am, an executive, mindful more than anything else of my own career and my own personal setting, and I have a choice to say yes or to say no. If I say yes, I'll be proven right, maybe with low probability, 10 years from now, and by then, everybody will take credit for it, everybody but me. And if I say no, then who can prove me wrong? I say no, it's a safe answer. So there's a tendency to turn down new ideas in large organizations in pharma. But the other point, which is unique here, is that there was money available for people to go out there and do that crazy stuff. And that money came from Wall Street. And biotechnology is nothing really, but it's very, very unique. And it's actually what personally excites me the most, that you sort of like you touch finance, medicine, laboratory science, and business. And all these things coming together is what makes biotech go around. So this unique interface is the fundamental aspect which we should be interested in. Now keep in mind, on Wall Street, history is an interesting proposition. It's either ignored, it is either revised, or it's misinterpreted. And in part is because nobody cares. Wall Street is so much real time, look forward, decide, make money, lose money, on to the next day, that people don't have the time to sit back and, you know, look historically and say, well, 10 years ago this thing happened, well, how does this apply today? They think you're a lunatic if you try to bring out these sort of paradigms and apply them to contemporary situations. In fact, I'll give you the simplest example of sort of like wrong history in Wall Street. Everybody, I asked groups of people in the industry, CEOs. I've asked this question in every lecture I've given. I said, what is the first IPO in biotech? And you know what? They either give me wrong answers. Well, in fact, they always give me wrong answers. But the best they can do is Genentech. Okay? That's universally accepted to be the first biotech IPO. It was October of 1980. It was done by Blythe Eastman Payne Weber. By the way, it's amazing. I was looking at a bunch of slides with prospectus covers. And but for those of you who don't know, this is the document. This is called an S-1. It's a regulatory filing. It's a document you file with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And that document enables you to sell stock in a new company. And it's called the IPO prospectus, IPO for initial public offering. And I have this precious library in my basement of nearly every prospectus in biotech from the very beginning, including the original. You know, one day they'll be like baseball cards, those things, you know, I'll be trading them with somebody else. But the funny thing is, if you look at the underwriters, the firms that did the deal, here's Blythe Eastman Payne Weber, not only changed a few names along the way, it's no longer in existence, it's now owned by UBS. Hamilton Quist, that's another name in the past, is now part of the JP Morgan Chase empire. Almost every name I have in this prospectuses belongs to somebody else now, and in fact every firm I worked at before has been acquired by somebody else, so I'm like, jinx. Anyway, everybody thinks that. You know what? Wrong. Who's got the right answers? Maybe I find truth here. Truth in Santa Barbara. Sounds like a movie title. Anybody? Enzo Biochem. This is data. This is facts. Read the date. June 12, 1980. It's not a marginal definition. Enzo Biochem is a legitimate biotech company. It was founded months after Genentech. It went public in this tiny deal with this obscure firm that went out of business because they were thieves and liars and cheats. It was the typical sweatshop, you know, it's like the people that call up and say, oh, I got a hot stock, you know, buy, 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 and then they dump the stock in the market and run away. And they're still in existence. They're still around, and they're surviving, and they're doing well. So here's how history is revised on Wall Street. Now, IPOs. 1980, this is the history, and let's talk about money. Two IPOs, the one I just mentioned, $39 million in total were raised. But of that 39, the 35 was Genentech, and that was one exciting IPO. Genentech came to market offering 1 million shares at $35 a share. Within 20 minutes, the stock was trading at 88. And it closed for the day at 56. Now, does this sound like eBay or Amazon or what you youngsters may remember from the last, you know, two to 3 years? Well, it was so exciting, everybody else wanted to do it, and that's why all the other things happened. So for most of the 80s, we had a reasonable level of activity. We had three deals in 81 and on, and here comes 86, which was a big year. And then something happened here. 1991, there was a major quantum change in the magnitude in the size of the industry, and whereas we had 5, 10, 15 IPOs, we had 35, and it was $1 billion. And guess what? Through the 90s, even the worst of years looked pretty good compared to the 80s. And then, of course, the year 2000, 63 IPOs, $5.3 billion, yet another change. I don't have time to go through the nuances of what brought about those changes. That in itself is a fascinating story of evolving technologies, finance, how the world of liquidity and funds changed, you know, the attention, the experience. But suffice it to say, the industry continues to grow and raise more money. And if you look at the cumulative capital raised over the years, it's about $77 billion. Now, that is only money raised by investors investing in companies that are publicly trading stock. It does not include venture capital. I would estimate the amount of venture capital that's going into biotech so far is maybe the tune of $10 billion. It does not include money that is coming from pharmaceutical partners in alliances. That money is probably another 50. So if you wanted to do, and these are harder to quantify, that's why these are exquisitely accurate numbers, painstakingly collected by yours truly when I'm bored at night. So if you want an aggregate number and say how much money has been poured into this industry, $150 billion since inception. That's a pretty good number, order of magnitude to think about. So it's a lot of money. Now, the money comes in at some price. As you put money into a company, you got to understand what is the value of the stock. I will be ignoring you guys over there because I'm right-handed, so I hope you don't take it personally. Just occupy with each other, just tell jokes or whatever, and I'll come back to you for Q&A at the end, see if you're paying attention. When you buy the stock, you have to assign a price to the stock. And that price for the stock reflects the aggregate value of the corporation. So how do you value these companies? And that has been an enormously complex challenge for biotech. My view is that there are three separate phases in the life of a company as it relates to valuation challenges. The first is when the company is pretty much in the sort of like pre-IPO, you know, the venture stage of the business, where the valuation is more of an intuitive approach to it. I'll come back to that in a second. Then there's a midpoint here that you can employ some other techniques, one of which I described here that I proposed back in 1986. And then, of course, when the company comes very close to maturation, is already introducing commercial products, and then you simply apply traditional techniques, typically, you know, a discounted cash flow methodology, which is widely available and understandable and understood in the world of finance. And you basically say, well, look, you know, I'm selling this today, and I expect to sell some more of that tomorrow and some more the day after, and I will do this for the next 20 years. So if all that money has been coming in, if I were to just somehow find a net present value for this and bring it in today, how much money would that mean today? And that's basically a discounted cash flow approach. Now, this part here is fascinating because it's driven by all sorts of things. Imagine this. You've got a little company, and you already have 10 employees, and you put a little bit of your own money, and you've got some ideas, some patents, you license from a university, some know-how, and now the first investors come in, you know, real professional investors put some money. Let's say they want to put in $10 million. You know, how much of the company would they buy for the $10 million? Well, do they buy 5% of the company, or do they buy 80% of the company? Well, let's use a simple number. If they bought 50% of the company, in other words, you own the company today, they give you $10 million, you give them now an equal ownership. That means now the total company is worth $20 million. Okay, so your equity, your sweat equity, your ideas, your licenses, the little work and the money you've done is now worth $10 million. It may sound like a lot, but it's only half of the whole. And you're going to do another round of financing, and you're going to be diluted some more, but the pie gets bigger, so you may own 30% of a bigger company, so that maybe if the company's not worth $100 million, it's $30 million, and it was 10, it was one before. So that goes on, but it's highly driven by subjective approaches. How big is the opportunity you're after? How good is your science? How good are your scientists? How good is your intellectual property? What is the competitive environment? Who else is doing similar things? Do you guys look like you know what you're doing? Is the management good? Who's on your board? Who is likely to be on your board? Who can be a scientific advisor? And lastly, supply and demand and ability to negotiate. But at the end of the day, going rate would be, under normal circumstances with good pedigree companies, you put $10 million in a startup and a first venture round, you give up half the company away. Some people don't like it. These are the facts. That's how it works. Now, what do you do later on? Well, I was troubled because when I first came into this business, I read every report written by an analyst on biotech companies. There were not that many at the time. So, and the reports were actually storytelling. They would describe the drugs pursued by the company, the technology, you know, the ideas, and then there'd be a paragraph at the end, and they would say, and we recommend the stock currently trading at $8 a share. And I'd been to business school at night, and I must say, of all the education I amassed, and I don't mean this as a And that's unique in my situation, I think. Of all the things I've learned and studied over the years, about the least important things in contributing to what I've done has been my MBA education. And I think it may be because MBA coming on top of a very quantitative background, as I was when I went to business school, probably didn't add a whole lot. But, you know, I must say it was my first class in accounting. The professor says, the fundamental equation of accounting, and I'm prepared to see the Schrodinger equation or the Dirac equation, something, you know, really sophisticated. And he says, assets is equal to liabilities plus shareholder equity. And I'm looking and I said, and he explained, I said, excuse me, I said, this is an identity. This is really not an equation. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, it's an identity. By the way, just if you want to be a mathematician, that's an identity. It's not an equation. There's no unknown to solve for. But I'd learned one thing in business school, which is there's a price where you like a stock, and there's a price where you sell it because the company is the same company, but at $5 is attractive to own. But at 85, it's just overpriced, and you better sell it before it goes down to 2. And you witness the internet stocks, and you know what it would have been like if you sold Amazon at 3,000 and you own it at 2 or whatever. So I felt there was a lack of rigor, a lack of quantitative connection in that regard. I said, there's got to be some answer. And what most people were suggesting was this really crazy long-term discounting approach, and I'll show that in a moment. And one day, I remember this eureka moment. I was driving in my old beat-up Toyota. I was fresh on Wall Street. I still had, you know, debts from my scientific life, so I couldn't afford a nice car. So I'm going home, and it hit me. I said, value these biotech companies is actually straightforward because these young biotech companies are nothing other than an academic lab. They're acting like an academic lab, and I've always told people since that time that, look, don't even think you're in a business. You know, discovering drugs in the context of a biotech company is a sport. It's not a business because if you spend 10 years losing money, not making any money, not selling anything, you go to work every morning, you're going to spend more money. That's like being, you know, on some sort of an allowance from your father. I mean, it's not a real life. So I said, these things look like academic labs. Now, I know about academic labs, and I did one of these, you know, in physics, you learn the so-called Gedanken experiments. You know, you create these sets of identical twins, so you eliminate all the complexity and you reduce it down to something. I said, well, I know what makes a good university lab. Good scientists, good ideas, time, and money. That's all it takes. If you do that, predictably, they will do good work. So why don't I parameterize this, you know, into some kind of a model that will enable me to value this company. So what I did is I created a complex algorithm that was a number, which was the R&D investment. And that R&D investment was a derivative number from the total amount I spent in R&D over the years, but by giving value to money spent earlier is more valuable, making corrections for how that got money, if they got money from a partner, they reduced rights. You know, I made all the adjustments so that at the end I will have an apples to apples comparison when I had this adjusted R&D number. And then I said, that's the hard part of this. Then I'll put an operator here into this equation. I'll use now my judgment to see how efficient it would be in turning this investment into results, into returns. So I said, well, I will rate this company subjectively in a scale from 1 to 10. In 3 areas, management, technology, and strategy. And each one of them had multiple subsets, you know, that I wouldn't bore you with. And I said, what's more, I make this publicly available, and somebody else can take this and, let me just go back for a second. And if they don't like my numbers, if they think management is an 8, not a 6, well, put your number in there and see what that means. So if you do that, you know, you create this different, you know, coefficients, and you create now at the end a normalized value index for the whole group and the individual company. You screen them all, and then, you know, you now show what are the deviations from the mean for the group. So this becomes an interesting screening tool to show you gross deviations. To the extent this is, to a large extent, subjective, and, you know, in dealing with numbers that have not been verified with any kind of a retrospective modeling of 50 years, you can rely on it, you know, that much. But would you say, if I see gross deviations, then these are companies worth exploring further. If they got a very big number, a green, they're interesting to buy. If they're a red like this, interesting to sell. And you go in. Now, interestingly enough, when I did this modeling, Amgen popped. This was back in 85. Amgen Pub is, I think Amgen may be this 160 here, as an undervalued stock, because based on what I thought about Amgen, I thought it was going to, you know, go places. And I went and did some work, and I recommended Amgen as a stock in 86, and, you know, it did very well, obviously, but everybody at the time liked Amgen, or you know, near the time. But the system also picked up, I think this one here was molecular genetics, a company that amounted to nothing. So the system is fairly flawed, but it's a tool. And more than anything, the tool had some discipline. It forced you to think quantitatively and put even your judgment into a parametric format and say, okay, now what do I think? What do you think? What do I think? And then move onward from there. And I used that, you know, for a while. Now here comes the discounted cash flow. And here's typically what people did. They even didn't do true DCF. Keep in mind, most of the people covering biotech stocks in the early years until today are of suspect financial background. They're mostly MDs or PhDs that sort of come and tell their reporters more than anything else, telling the stories about the drugs and stating the obvious, but never really thought, you know, in very sophisticated ways about the math and the finance concepts behind it. So here we go, and what they do is you choose a year, a terminal year, you calculate the earnings per share for that year, then you choose a multiplier, you know, by what number do you multiply this earnings per share to give value now because you expect growth and accrued value, and then you discount this back to reflect the risk involved, and you know, that's the equation here. Now, people use this all the time. Let me show you what a true scientist could do with these numbers. Let's do some boundary conditions. Let's assume that you choose, the assumption you make is you're going to go after a five-year projection, only 5 years, which is pretty short. Your EPS, everything is some variance. I mean, nothing is exactly. You're not going to predict the company's earnings per share 5 years from now to the penny. If you go between $1 and $2, even that is great. Okay, but assume that the difference between $1 and $2, your PE, because you know the growth rate of the market PE at the time, range from 20 to 50, and the discount rate, different perceptions of risk, range between those numbers. If you do the boundaries here, the prediction is a range from $2.60 to $40.20. And guess what? That is completely useless because, you know, you can drive a truck through that, say, on Wall Street with a range like this, because typically you like to know something. What if your stock today is 8? It doesn't teach you anything. So this is completely useless, but it's widely used. In fact, it's used backwards. People decide what stock they like. People decide what price they like to recommend it at, and then they fudge the numbers to give them an answer that looks, the stock today is 12, they like it, they say, well, it should be at 18 in 12 months from now, and the numbers come back by choosing the right part within the range. Now, as companies grow, part of this valuation and efficiency creates a fascinating phenomenon that we witnessed in the early 80s, and it's what I termed the profitability paradox, that companies go through a period of losing money, and at that point, they're valued as sort of like technological assets with promise. And then at some point they start making money, and of course they are valued now more traditionally, but as they transition here, they usually experience a dip in price. And the dip in price is because people begin to tend to value them off of these very low numbers, so to justify a high stock price, you know, you have to have very high PE, and people get nervous and say, well, the PE here is 1,000. You know, keep in mind a typical market PE is 12, 15, 18, 20 for industrial companies, depending on the time of, you know, the period of time you're in. It was a time a few years ago, it was up to 30 for aggregate. And many biotech companies have had 1,000 or 500, many IT companies. But so that's an important consequence. And that has led us into a number of financing structures that were there to eliminate these losses. So what we did, in order to smooth the profit and loss statement of biotech companies, we sort of like put in place back in the early 80s, the concept of research and development limited partnerships. Now, limited partnerships have been around forever. And most of what I will tell you is interesting in that the invention is usually a small increment, a small deviation from something else adapted cleverly to the environment with significant impact. So, limited partnerships have been around forever, largely as tax sheltering instruments. Keep in mind, though, in 1986, the law changed, and that no longer was the case, but in biotech, these R&D LPs persisted for a number of years, largely because they were never sold as tax shelters. They were sold largely as exciting opportunities to participate in unique products with great companies. We evolved a different structure called SPARCs, stands for Special Purpose Accelerated Research Corporations, and then ultimately Tracking Stock, and I'll walk you through all this evolution of what brought about those changes in structure. First, what's a research and development limited partnership? You begin with a company, the sponsor company, and then that sponsor company forms a subsidiary, which is to be a limited partnership. Into the subsidiary, they're going to deploy some technology, and they will expect to get a deal from them that they will develop, they will do some research here on behalf of the limited partnership. Now, for the limited partnership to give money to the sponsor company to do the research, it's got to get it from someplace. It gets it from people, from investors. These investors put the money into the LP, and in exchange, they own now the LP. They own limited partnership interest. Of course, the company doesn't want to part with the technology and put in here and walk away from it because that would be suicidal. So they need to have a way to get it back. So how do they get it back? They cut a deal with the partners and they say, okay, we want an option to purchase back from you all that stuff that we're developing, and here's what we're going to do. To compensate you for this, we're going to give you some warrants in our stock. So that's the basic structure of an R&D LP. And this, some of these features have been put later. There were the warrants, they're not always there. The purchase options, I mean, these things can get very complex from a structuring point of view. Now, this thing started largely with Genentech. The first few were done by Genentech, because Genentech, the genius of Bob Swanson is that he understood he had to smooth his profit and loss statement. He couldn't show big losses and get Wall Street worried, so he would fund R&D this way, because guess what happens? Let me just go back for a second here. What happens is, the reason why this is valuable, important, is because if I, let's say I was going to spend $100 in doing R&D. Now I create this little entity here, and now this entity raises the money, so this entity gives me $110 to do $100 worth of R&D. I even have a $10 profit. Now, well, I've given up something. I've given up the technology here, and I've got to buy it back. But guess what? I don't have to buy it back. So if it fails, I walk away. It's their money, their loss. Goodbye. If it works, I buy it back. And when I buy it back, I will go give a big lump sum or give some royalties. And depending on the situation, I can probably deal with it. I'll show you two cases of how this thing has worked out. So, but for now, rather than showing $100 of loss in R&D, I actually have $10 of profit because of this arrangement. I'm basically postponing my obligation. I change around the interaction between my balance sheet and my profit and loss statement. How many of those have been done? Well, here's the history, starting with Genentech, raised $56 million in 1982, onward from there. I will focus here in 1987 in one of those by Amgen. One, because I knew Bruce was going to be here. It's not true, but it's a good excuse. George Rathman is special to UC Santa Barbara, and George Rathman was the founding CEO of Amgen, but also because it's extraordinarily successful, and I'll show you what the numbers are of people who invested in this. And this is the history of all of them. The vast majority of them have been done by Payne Weber, because we had a very specialized group doing this and understanding what it takes to do those. Now, here's the Amgen partnership. And keep in mind now the sort of returns we're talking about. As they sold this limited partnership, and the aim was to develop GCSF, a drug called Neupogen that's in the market now, a multi-billion-dollar drug, they were promising that if all goes well, they will return people 12 times their money. And that would have been a 34% internal rate of return over a 20-year period. That's a pretty good return. Well, what do you think happened? Here are the facts. It was done in June 87, $84 million. And here's what happened. Depending on whether you exercise your warrants at the highest price for Amgen, if you're that smart, or whether you just wait until the end and exercise them near expiration, this is what you have. Including what you expect to get for the next 2 years, which is a couple more years left for the partnership to run. For $100,000 investment, okay, one unit, $1,750,000 in royalties, and this in warrants. So you made between $2.5 and $3+ million for $100,000, and that's, you can calculate, 25 to 33 times your money. And the internal rate of return, 56% to 96%, extraordinary. By far and away, nothing comes close to this in this industry. Now, that business is going on, and if you recall, if I just take you back quickly, and you look at the years here, you can see that this thing did very well all through here. Now, around here, okay, is where we're going to go now. And around here is this interesting thing that happened. there was a drug delivery company outside of the mainstream of biotech called Alza. And Alza had actually a very industrious CEO, industrious both as a good CEO and also as a good financial guy. And they came up, and there's a lot of stories as things have come up and been structured together, but they came up with this idea of doing basically a rights offering for warrants. And they decided to add some technology into that little package. And a rights offering is as follows. Let's assume that all of you own stock in Alza. One morning, I, the CEO, and the board declare that you will receive 30 days from now a right to purchase a warrant in the company. Now, for that right to be valuable, it should enable you to buy that warrant at less than fair value. Otherwise, why would you bother? You can just go buy the warrant on your own. So that little delta is a gift. It's a dividend I give you, and that's the value of the right. So they did this, and there were some plans to buy it back. We at Paine Webber, this was actually advised by Merrill Lynch. We at Paine Webber raised the alarm because we said this was likely to be a major threat to our limited partnership business and what do we do about it. One of my colleagues, actually still my partner today, was commissioned by me to do an analysis, and he wrote this lengthy report of the pluses and minuses and the flaws of that structure. But at the end, we figured the train was leaving the station. We had to understand them and do something about it. And here's basically how this thing worked. It was nothing but a limited partnership, a sponsor company again. Instead of a limited partnership, it was a corporation here, and we just parceled together the warrants and the shares together in a unit, so on the shareholders. It was very much like a limited partnership, except that instead of an organizational element on a limited partnership, there was a corporation. And there's some differences and changes here, but that was it. One of our best clients at Paine Webber was Centocor. Centocor was visited upon by Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch did the Alza deal. They said, now we get technology. We'll go around. They go to Centocor. They said, we can do the same thing with you. And they spent 6 months working. Then Centocor calls up and says, okay, Merrill Lynch got this great idea. We're loyal to you guys. We've done a lot of business. We invite you to come in and be part of the deal, you know, but, you know, it's their leadership. So we get on the train, we go to Philadelphia, we're fighting amongst ourselves. Should we, you know, become uppity and walk away and say, go to hell, this is a bad idea? Should we, you know, sort of like swallow our pride and go along? What do we do? What do we do? So we go there and we engage in discussion. And it takes a long while. That discussion took a good, I'd say, 6 months because of the newness of it all and all the complexity. And along the way, you know, in our, you know, attempt to, you know, win over the client, we started proposing more and more aggressive terms. And Merrill Lynch at some point says, well, forget it. I'm not going to do it for those terms. So we're not the drivers still, except we have a deal we may not be able to sell because it's so damn aggressive. We don't know what we're going to do with it. But what do you do? That's what you do on Wall Street. You just hope. And along the way, on the eve of filing the deal, we realized a major problem. The problem was the following. Centocor was a company organized in Pennsylvania. Now, most corporations, as many of you know, are incorporated instead of Delaware, which is very user-friendly in terms of corporate governance. Centocor was in Pennsylvania, and in Pennsylvania, under Pennsylvania corporate law, you may not issue a dividend unless you're a profitable company on an operating basis. We didn't even know that. Nobody thought about it. And some lawyers sprout a little thing, and, you know, the day before, we say, oh, my God, what do we do now? And then somebody in the room says, why don't we just underwrite this like a regular public offering of stock? Well, look, I said, well, why not? And we just looked perplexed, and they said, oh, what the hell, we should just do it and see what happens. And we did it. And there was this deal here, the Tocor transaction of Centocor. And it happened, and that was very much like a limited partnership, and I'll show you the structure in a moment. That gave birth to this whole group of deals that were done. By the way, these are total tables. Every deal and no deal is missing, and it's not that many. So this is where we are. Now, let me tell you the evolution of these structures. This was the basic idea I described before with Alza. Here's the underwriting we do with Tocor, and then we move back forward into more complex structures and more complex structures, and I'll discuss those in a moment. Here was Tocor. Here's the prospectus again. Paine Webber, Hampton and Quist, both gone. And here were the buyback provisions as described here. And here the rate of returns. Already now, we're cutting down in the returns. Amgen was 34%, even in the outer years, now 32. But here, if you read the fine print, we said there's a royalty provision as well. When we moved into this transaction for Genzyme, it was another one of those things. The CEO of Genzyme wanted to fund six different projects. And he wanted, He didn't want this uncertainty of the royalties. He says, if I'm successful, I pay an arm and a leg. It's too much money. I want to know what's going to cost me to buy them back. He says, can I know that? So one night I'm sitting in my house. I said, why not? I said, here's it. I says, we'll define the defined buyback option. So we'll, there's a term I coin, I'm good at coining terms. So we took the six projects and I said, here's what we're going to do. We'll give you an a la carte choice. And if you want to buy each of them individually, you'll pay so much money. And we'll weight this based on the risk and the amount of money invested. And I went around the room when we're drafting the prospectus. I said, okay, in a scale from 1 to 5, I want all of you to vote in a piece of paper and put the risk you perceive in each project. I collected it all, and then I concluded that that was the best way to grade the returns. This is CFTR, that's a cystic fibrosis transport protein. I mean, that's a very risky project that failed clearly. It would cost him 60% internal rate of return to buy it back. Then we said, but if you're going to buy it all at once, I'll give you a little volume discount. So the ultimate purchase price was governed by this equation where this was the individual returns and the risk involved with the individual projects. And this was the D, was the little discount factor, a 15% volume discount I gave him that he could buy the whole thing, by exercising a one-off. And that went on. And then I was increasingly bothered by the fact that when these things worked, there were windfall. Because the company did well, they bought back the partnership at the high 20s, and the warrants did very well. And if it didn't work, it was a bust. So I invented this other structure with the so-called callable back-end warrants. So I split the amount of warrants, and I gave only half up front. And it was an interesting and intricate structure of how it worked. But the other half could only spring into being if the buyback was not exercised and they were priced at the then prevailing prices. The thing being, the company will not exercise the buyback provision if things don't go well. And if they don't go well, probably the stock price is low. So at least you're going to get some cheap warrants at the back end to ease the pain and maybe hope for a better day. But keep in mind again, we're dropping the returns here continuously because the competition is just breathing down our neck. And this was so complicated, only two deals were done like this, both by my group. They involved offshore corporations to alleviate some income issues, some tax issues, and a few other things. But the worst thing that happened was that this deal, and by the way, look at the firms again. Payne Webber gone. First Boston is now CSFB. H&Q gone. JP Morgan is actually acquired by Chase, and they took the name. This business was very hot, all of this. R&D and Sparks were very hot in the 80s and early 90s. This, believe it or not, is the percent of total capital raised. In other words, in 1984, 63% of all the money raised on Wall Street was done by these funky structures. 75% in 1988. Now, as the money got bigger, in 91, only 4%, because when the money is cheap and easy and you can, the market is permissive, who cares about funky structures? And then it completely disappeared. This last deal here, there were a couple of deals done at, in 97, and that's the end of this whole idea. And it died for two reasons. One was because CentoCore got into deep trouble in 92, and we had to negotiate a buyback of TOCore too, and all of a sudden, this option prices with the market assumed automatically the companies will buy them back, didn't work out. And they started seeing the lower prices, and every other deal after that was negotiated and not exercised. And the other point is that if they worked, and all companies believe their stuff works, they were expensive, no matter how we cut it. And then I came up with this other idea of tracking stock. And this was, again, not my idea. The idea of this divisional organizational existed through GM. GM had different businesses, Hughes Aircraft, electronic data systems, and these were different businesses than automotive, so they had separate divisions, separate stocks for those. They were called either letter stock or alphabet stock. First Boston came up with the idea of taking that concept and applying to research and development and creating a research subsidiary and a holding company doing the rest. And toyed with this idea, I went to Genzyme, one of my better clients. Spent 6 months working, Genzyme called me up and said, okay, First Boston has this great idea, we think we want to do it, tell us we're wrong or tell us we're right. What do you think? So I gave the documents to my guys again, and the uninvented here syndrome applies everywhere. We're the masters of structure. We've done it all. We know this is a bad idea. I said, guys, this may be a bad idea, and I agree with you. I said, but the client is telling you something. They're telling you they want some other structure away from those sparks. So if it's a bad idea, give me a good idea. Well, they didn't. So one day, here I was again. This time I was not driving an old Toyota. Now I'd made more money. I was skiing in Colorado. So upscale, skiing down the mountain. As I'm skiing down the mountain, I got this idea how to fix the problems with the structure. So I still have in my files a four-page written fax I wrote to the CFO of Genzyme of what we needed to do. And that was the genesis of tracking stock. There are a number of advantages here, but let's first describe a little bit what it is. You take a corporation and pick a large organization that you can recognize. Take a company like Abbott. Abbott has a major pharmaceuticals division and a major diagnostics division. They exist already. They operate divisionally. They are separate in many ways, but they come together at the top management and at the board. They share some functions. So you take the corporate, you break it up into a general division and a new division. And the I guess my invention was that rather than separating R&D here and the rest here, I said that looks like cheating. What we got to do is let's deconvolute a business into things that are recognizable. And my predicament is, you go back to this profitability paradox, as the company was shifting, you know, any company could be divided as a mature organization with products and sales and profits, like a Genzyme moving forward, and then a money-losing part, which was like a little biotech company. If you put them together, you got a company losing money or making a little bit of money and having business, and what multiple do you put on it? If you separate them in two, then it's easy for Wall Street to figure out, because they know how to deal with a money-losing biotech company or a mature organization. So this deconvolution was basically my invention, and I proposed that we do this with vertically integrated businesses. So we put here a tissue regeneration business that was a fledgling business. We kept here the other stuff. And I will. There's a lot of technical stuff, and I'm running out of time, so I will skip over that. Let me just go to the mechanical stuff. So you take the general division, and you give to all the corporation shareholders, you take the old shares back, and give them, you know, new shares for this division and new shares for that division. You can, in fact, if you want, you can do an IPO for that division, you can do an acquisition of that division. The most important point, and I will come to the, I'll skip that, I'll show you this is worth seeing now. Let me tell you what happens here, how the income statement changes. This is real. This is the exact income statement of Genzyme, and I will describe all the features here of this structure, of Genzyme through those 4 years. In December 94 is when they announced the formation of Genzyme Tissue Repair. So look what happens. What you don't see here, unfortunately, because of the way the slide was done at the last minute, the first three is the Genzyme General Division. This is the Genzyme Tissue Repair Division, and this is the consolidated financial statements. So you will see that in the year 96, Genzyme General Division was $511 million of revenues, seven for the Tissue Repair Division, the consolidated is 518. So this column here is nothing but the simple algebraic sum of this column and that column. Okay, that's easy enough. So here's now what happens. The bulk of the sales stayed with the General Division. That's pretty easy. Now let's go down to research and development. You have 70 million here. You have 11 million. Clearly, the proportion of R&D here is, you know, 12, 13% of the R&D is here. This is nowhere near the percent of sales that goes to this organization. So where this organization is likely to benefit in having better profit and loss statement, this clearly would be a money-losing proposition. There you go. You're losing $73 million here. Now, there's something else here which is very interesting, and it's the following. When it comes down to the tax issues, now you've got here pre-tax, I'm sorry, let's just go here to 95, which is a money-making year, okay? That's important because there's another transaction here. 95, the pre-tax income is $65 million for the general division, okay? Now, normally the tax allocation would be $30 million. So you'd be having $35 million of net profit. Except that over here, you also lost some money. But you're losing money, you don't pay taxes. So now this is a so-called net operating loss carry forward. Most companies have these NOLs for a long time, but they have no great use to them. Now the beauty of this thing is that because you pay taxes as a corporation, you're allowed to shift the money. So what they do is the actual total bill for the company was $43 million. That was their consolidated pre-tax income. The real tax was 21, not 30, so they get a credit for 9. So now not only they've shed some R&D over here, they also get a tax benefit. So instead of having 22 million consolidated net income, it's 44. Powerful. They double their net income. Powerful. Guess what's more powerful? You report all those things. You report consolidated and the divisions. So you say, well, it's transparent. Well, it is transparent. But guess what? It doesn't matter because all that matters is earnings per share. That's what people look because they hold shares. And I cannot have earnings per share here. Guess why I cannot have earnings per share? There's no piece of paper that represents the consolidated operations. I have either paper for the general division or the tissue repair division. Now, the only thing you can say to me is, well, clearly, under the consolidated situation, this would have been, you know, 22 million must be 33 cents per share because 44 is 66. Okay, so now you upped the earnings per share, you doubled it. Question is, if the market is smart, it should penalize you and it should reduce your profit and the PE multiple and the price to earnings multiple, so you're going to adjust for the stock price. I said, okay, let's look at that. So then I went, first of all, I looked at Genzyme, and without a doubt, the Genzyme General Division net income was always better than the consolidated income in any one year. So they always managed to shelter income that way. And then I asked the question about the PE. Well, what do you think? Here's an interesting chart. This yellow line is the S&P 400 price to earnings multiple over the years. And here's what Genzyme is. So even, you know, it was here prior to the announcement of the first formation. It was a little above, a little above, a little above, a little below. So it's noise. It clearly did not go down to half of what it was to compensate for this. So clearly, the aggregate value of Genzyme value was generated by being uncoupled for this deconvolution I talked about. So that was a significant mechanism. And Genzyme did multiple of those and reformulated and reformatted them. And a couple of others followed suit, but not very many. And ultimately, what happened was, and this is the date is May 12th or something, Genzyme consolidated striking section to Genzyme General. Genzyme brought it all back home. And here are the quotes. We are very aware of the instruction of the tracking stock structure was causing the investment community, said Henry Termeer. And here's another guy says, if I'm a shareholder, I'm elated. The nice surprise is that when we went to multi-consolidation, it made sense for the first time. Revisionist thinking. But why did this happen? Because ultimately, and that's fascinating, ultimately Genzyme got penalized. Their PE started dropping down here because the market, Genzyme abused the concept. They started shifting things back and forth, self-dealing, and the market rep says, now, wait a second. Anytime something good comes up, you move the general division. If a bad thing comes up, you leave it there. You move money, you make loans. That, I don't like that. Whereas there's another one called Celera, which is a division of the Aplera Corporation, and because Celera is the big genomics database and now drug discovery company, and the other is Applied Biosystems that sells boxes, instruments, very different businesses, people don't even know that Celera and Applied Biosystems are divisional tracking stocks of the Aplera Corporation. So there the system worked. Here it didn't. Anyway, so that rapidly brings me to an end here, and I spoke longer than I should have. What are the lessons here? The lesson, what I want to convey to you is the most important thing that I found is you come to these problems as if they are problems. You look at them as if they're nothing but inefficiencies in the marketplace for some reason. You identify the reason and you just sit back and you customize a solution. On occasion, you use mathematics. In fact, mathematical thinking and scientific thinking is a lot less apparent in the ultimate result, which is simple algebra. It's a lot more apparent in the way you tackle the problem. And I think I've always felt that in looking at, if I wanted to name myself one thing, you know, what are you, a finance guy, an investment banker, you know, whatever, I probably, if I'm not embarrassed to say it out loud because I cannot call myself that anymore, I'd say I'm a physicist because I think like a physicist in my own quiet little ways. I tackle problems like a physicist. And in that regard, it can generate an incredible advantage. I have an MBA like 1,000 other people on Wall Street. Why did I come up with these things? Another guy, some Harvard Wharton and 25 years of financial education, is because I simply said, well, there's a problem, let's solve it. And I think that's probably the most important message I can convey to you youngsters. And now I'll have some water. I'll thank you for your attention, and we'll take some questions, although the time is a bit short, I understand. Thank you.